I'm Josh Cooperman, and this is Convo by Design. Stephen Francis Jones is an architect with offices in Marina Del Rey, California. Stephen is the principal of SF Jones Architects, a unique firm that has turned architectural design for restaurants into somewhat of an art form. I don't use that term lightly, and as you will hear, Jones doesn't either. As the in-house architect for Wolfgang Puck, he helped set the tone for the dining experience that led to a very successful global brand. His objective is to create an environment that matches the food, the sensory experience that serves to enhance the dining experience. Restaurant design and architecture is Jones' stated true calling, and his work is evidence of that. Think about this for a moment. The elements that go into designing a space that must accommodate professional-grade appliances, satisfy local, regional, and state codes, and provide an environment that matches the expected dining experience? As complicated as that sounds, listen to Stephen explain how he does it. His laid-back style seems to pair beautifully with the notoriously intense style and expectations of the service industry. This is Stephen Francis Jones of SF Architects. I hope you enjoy this episode of Convo by Design. If you do, please consider giving us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. You know it better as iTunes. And check out short videos from these conversations on our YouTube channel. Convo by Design is presented by Snyder Diamond. Always first with what's next in the kitchen and bath. That is the philosophy of second-generation president Russ Diamond. He scours the planet looking for the appliances, fixtures, and finishes for the kitchen and bath that allow designers and architects to create amazing spaces for their clients. Products like those from Miele. I was recently given a tour of the Miele showroom and shown all of the products that Miele has to offer, from coffee machines to ovens, ranges, hoods, combi steam ovens, washers, dryers, all made with the Immer Besser philosophy hard-coded into the very DNA of this family-owned and operated company since their founding in 1899. Miele products are made to serve and built to last. They possess the form and function you expect, and they were created with the future in mind. The technology integrated into these appliances is simply amazing, and they were designed to work seamlessly together, all to make life that much easier. Now, combine this world-class product with the amazing Snyder Diamond service, and you have a really powerful partnership. Find out more at any of the 3 Los Angeles area Snyder Diamond showrooms and check out some fantastic limited-time offers and promotions from Miele while you're there. You can also learn more at SnyderDiamond.com. I think that that is an interesting concept that, as trained as an architect, but you can do design, you can do lighting, it doesn't have to be multifaceted, it doesn't have to be split up. Have you always approached it that way?
I've always approached it that way. And being a smaller firm and being able to get projects where you're working with people who are, a lot of times the mom and pops that are starting restaurants that have limited access to finance, and we need to be creative with their space. You can't necessarily go out and hire a lighting designer and an interior designer, and so it's to me it's always been something that I felt that if you're going to design a space, you should also think about how it's going to be lit, and how, if there's an architectural feature that you feel is important and you take it to the next level of lighting it properly. A lot of the projects I do, which are restaurants, it's about setting the ambiance and creating the space volumetrically, but also lighting it in the same fashion. So, then when you start, one of the things I think as an architect, I worked for bigger firms at one time, and architects basically did the buildings, and then when it came to picking materials, everybody was really scared of it. It's like, we'll let someone else do that. And I just kept thinking, it's like, why would you want to let someone else do that? Why wouldn't that always just kind of
okay? So let me flip the script on you a little bit, or play the other side of that question. Mm-hmm. If you're an architect, mm-hmm. and you're especially at a smaller firm, mm-hmm. right, where you're trying to foster and develop and encourage more business to come in, mm-hmm. and you're spending time researching textiles, mm-hmm. and sofas and light fixtures and bathroom fixtures, mm-hmm. and holy, I mean, you can go down the rabbit hole quickly and lose yourself. Yes?
Yes, but you know, I think, you know, after some years of being able to, you know, find resources and to be, you know, one of the fortunate things now with the internet and everything is that you can really resource, you know, rather quickly. But when I started my business, I did have that problem of like, you know, how am I going to find materials? You know, I don't have anything accessible to me right now. So it's my biggest thing was to trying to like keep a good library of materials and create a reputation with the vendors who knew the kind of work that we did, and they would come to us to bring in us the new cool stuff, you know, going to the shows and seeing what's out there, and being able to kind of, you know, walk a show and have a project in mind, and or have a type of projects that you're doing in mind. And so I think that it's, you know, it's something that you have to build. You know, you also rely on some people. I've got a lighting designer that he's more of a distributor that I've been working with forever. And so, you know, you build these relations with artisans who can make pieces for you, and, you know, vendors who bring in cool stuff to you. And so it doesn't happen overnight, but I think that I enjoy that part of it. You know, I don't like to leave a portion of it. I mean, I like to collaborate, and by no means do I think that I can do it all. But when you collaborate with like our graphic designer, who's able to, you know, add some value and collaborate with items, it really creates a special working relationship, and I think that gets translated into the design.
I don't want to call it specialized. You tell me if you specialize in restaurant architecture. Do you specialize in that?
Yeah, I specialize in restaurant architecture.
What do you like about designing restaurants?
When I first moved to L.A., I went to UCLA grad school, and I'd been working in Boston, working on high rises, and you know, and I didn't really see my work that I worked on these big high rises, you know, come to life. You know, I've worked 2.5 years for one firm and never even started. I worked on one big giant project, and when I came out here, I had a friend of mine who was working for a boutique design firm, and they were doing restaurants, and so I was working with him, and I just, you know, there's something about a restaurant space that you know, it has the kitchen component, it has the functionality, it has to run like a fine-tuned car. I mean, it, you know, a big engine, but a sexy body, you know, and 150 miles an hour all the time, you know. And so, you know, one of the things that that I found intriguing working with Wolfgang Puck in my earlier part of my career was I learned about, you know, how they operated, what was important, you know, in terms of the flow, and then. So that gave me a good, you know, basis for understanding, you know, what goes into designing a restaurant. And so, you know, they're relatively quick, you know, usually between 9 months and a year from the time they, and then there's the, you know, you get to go visit them.
Well, it's interesting that you say that too. You know, you're absolutely right, because the clock is ticking. With a restaurant, you're paying rent when you're, or you know, whatever the whatever the deal is. But when you're building out, when you're creating that space and that structure, you're paying rent or some, there's something happening. There's some back channel money working.
Yeah, you know, and that's the thing. It's like you have to work fast.
Yeah,
because you know, they're not going to sign my contract until they sign their lease, or until they're ready to sign their lease. And you know, when they sign that lease, they've got a time that's clicking, and it has to go through the process of getting permitted and everything. And so, and then back to my original idea about having to doing everything, is like you don't really have time to have other disciplines to, you know, on their schedule to work out with this. So it, you know, works better to be able to have that kind of in-house. And I've got a really strong team right now, so I'm really happy about that.
Oh, see, that's everything.
It's everything.
Some of your favorite projects?
That I've done?
Yeah.
Or just,
yeah.
Well, I really love MB Post. And part of it was because, you know, I was fortunate enough to be able to design my own home in Manhattan Beach. And the second best thing you could do is design a restaurant in your community. So I was really, you know, David Lefebvre, you know, wanted to have something that, you know, talked about community. And it was a post office, so MB Post. And the whole, you know, decor is kind of, you know, lifeguard stands that I photographed along the beach, and volleyball post, you know, that kind of mixed into the whole thing. So that one's pretty fun.
And wood and glass.
Yeah, wood and glass, and you know, it's funny. We did this in 2011, and it was really before a lot of the reclaimed would start taking over. Now you look at MB Post and it's kind of like, well,
you know what's really interesting, and it's being very, very familiar with that particular restaurant, and we were joking before, I said it was the home of bacon, because they put bacon in, they put bacon in the mug.
Yeah.
They're remarkable.
They are.
So
cheddar bacon.
Yeah, and it's a comfort food restaurant. The style of the architecture is one of those where it perfectly pairs with the food.
Yeah, it does.
Was that an intentional design?
You know, it was intentional in the sense of, I mean, there's we design these communal tables, and the communal tables, you know, the idea was of having shared plates, you know, and so we came up with a design where the middle, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, with the two communal tables when you come in, it has an elevated section in the middle where people can put their plates up. So you're not like reaching over somebody else to grab their food. And then also I put this big long light that goes straight over it and really highlights it. And so the food the food is really on show. And the light is, you know, focused on the center so that you're not, you know, blasted with light in your face. And so, you know, the aesthetic of the space and the food, you know, really do go well together. And I think that, you know, it was definitely intentional. I think that one was
yeah, and it pairs perfectly. Some others that you've worked on that you think really captured the essence. And by the way, when I say this, you know, these are, I'm just asking what some of your favorite projects are, because I think you can tell a lot about certain creatives when they talk about their own projects.
Right.
You know, it's very easy to talk about somebody else. Yeah. You know, here's what I liked, here's what I didn't like, because there's no personal connection really.
Right.
You know,
right.
But, you know, the other side of that is a lot of people say, oh, well, I don't have any favorites. Okay, well, that's not true.
Yeah.
We all know that.
Exactly.
You just don't want to talk about the favorites. So I love to hear the stories, because you know what? Creatives glow when they talk about their favorite projects.
Yeah. Well, you know, another one of my favorites is La Brea Bakery. So that project was one that we had to move the original La Brea Bakery down the street It was part of what's right now Republic. And the original bakery that that was there was moved over. And really it was about, you know, we created this really long display, almost like a jewelry box, that displayed, you know, all of the their bakery goods as if they were, you know, it was their, you know, their jewelry, you know. And then we also, you know, they had the ability to bake bread in their factory that was close by, so they were able to bring in fresh bread to the place. And but we wanted to be able to kind of give a hint that, you know, maybe all the bread is made there, you know. And so, you know, we have a bread oven that you can peekaboo see through, and so it's, you kind of see, like, you know, the watch, the gears, and a watch with the glass face on it, and you kind of see what's going on behind there. So, you know, it was really a fun project, and, you know, taking things, you know, it's funny because I don't recall all of the reasons for inspiration, but, you know, when the booths, you know, we basically had these two booths that were like, if you were taking a piece of bread and breaking it apart, and the center part, which was these table with different type of wood, that were different colors of wood. You know, we had a walnut and a padauk and a maple, and it was almost as if, you know, slices of bread that was pumpernickel, and, you know, so these little things that, you know, are stories that I have to explain to somebody, you know, about why it's there, but, you know, these little stories, I just love having these little stories and being able to, like, say, well, here's the genesis of that.
and you like that concept of communal architecture.
I do. I really do. And I, you know, I focused on restaurants because restaurants is really, you know, well, I focused on it because that that is where I, you know, got my start with Spago and so kind of like elevated me to expertise level in the restaurants. But then, you know, lately I've been thinking about how restaurant spaces translates into other public spaces. And one of the things that that we've been working on have been projects that are like amenities to, you know, workspaces. You know, there's, you know, trying to create like a blur between work and play, and using food as something to bring people together. You know, I think that is where the trends are going now. I mean, you look at this place here at this smorgasbord, you know, and it's really, you know, getting people to come out, taste different types of food, almost like, you know, a potluck dinner, you know, where everybody brings their own flavor and you create a community with food. And so, so, you know, I think that that the restaurants are a vehicle to be able to accomplish that, be it, you know, small. I mean, right now I'm focusing on, like, really small restaurants, you know, outside communal areas. I just finished a project at the new Bank of California football stadium, and it's basically a beer garden using a shipping container.
Tell me about that. Tell me about working with a shipping container. How was that to work with?
You know, it was, you know, I've been like thinking about how this, you know, how that using a shipping container would be able to be used as a building module, and I think that you know, there is a conception that that there, because it's a shipping container, it's cheap, you know, but it's not very cheap at all. It's really like building a little car.
Well, okay, but wait a minute. So the structure itself, like, you can go to Wilmington where they have literally thousands and mm-hmm. thousands of these piled on top of each other. You can get the steel box.
Yeah.
But that's never
the issue is the steel box.
That's the easy part. You know, you can get one for $20,000, you know, and so, you know, you feel like you're halfway there, but, you know, it's really, you know, working small is really difficult. You know, it's, you know, doing big restaurants, you know, 5,000 to 7,000 square foot restaurants, you have enough space where you can, you know, you can do stuff. When you start working small, you really can't, you know, you're really limited to what you can do, and your efficiency of space and how it's utilized. And then add on top of that, having to address, you know, issues like ADA compatibility, making it health department, you know, approved. You know, there's so many rules and regulations that go in, then you don't really have much, you know, opportunity to you know, make any mistakes, you know, because it's all, everything's so small that, you know, you have to be as efficient as you can with the thing. Now, one of the good things about, you know, using the shipping containers is, and in particular the ones that we just finished at the LA Football Club, is that, you know, we were able to build it in a shop in Oakland, and while we were getting it permitted. You know, because it's a state approved certification, and then we literally, you know, got our permit. They drove it down on Saturday. We put it in place on craned it in on Monday, and then we had our the ribbon cutting ceremony on Wednesday.
See, that's great.
That is cool,
because you can do your design build in a totally
controlled
environment. Yeah. It's the greatest thing.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is that that, you know, and that's the thing about the shipping containers. I think that they're not a cheap alternative, but they've got the cool factor, you know, and then they're also mobile, you know, so you could, you know, I have been kind of conceiving the shipping containers as being like the bridge between brick and mortar and food trucks, because you know, I think that. That has been, you know, the brick and mortar to build the restaurant, you know, these days is just so expensive. I mean, I don't know how people can do it. You know, I mean, you have to invest at least $2 million into.
Yeah. This is Convo by Design. We're at the LA Design Festival, where we're recording for both Convo by Design and Design Etc., which is the official podcast of the LA Design Festival. On Friday, when we opened, we had Steve Sampson, who is the owner chef at Rosa Blue, and we were talking about this very same thing.
Yeah.
I don't think that most people really, it's not they don't understand it, I just don't think that they think about it.
Yeah.
That when you walk into a restaurant, the amount of money, the amount of investment
that you have to do
is monumental.
It's monumental. And the commitment that you're making. I mean, you know, hopefully you have a space, you know, but, you know, you're signing a 15-year lease, and you're putting in $2 million to build the thing, and then, you know, you have to train, and you have to, you know, get everything properly, you know, up and running. And, you know, if a restaurant fails, you know, after a year or so, I mean, it's like, you know, you don't recover that. I mean, it's...
No, you don't. And it's funny, too, because I was asking Steve about that, because Jonathan Gold came in, and they got a stellar review, and they're on the top 100 restaurants in Los Angeles, and it's great. That, you have a bad night.
Yeah.
A server has a bad night. A chef has a bad night. Something goes wrong.
Right.
I mean, everything could go down the tubes with, you know, it's just, you think about it, holy moly.
That's no, it's, I mean, it could be, you know, so we did a restaurant in Santa Monica, it was called Anisette, and it was on 2nd Street, and it was in the old clock tower building. And it was a bank before, and we like put in, this is like 2007, you might see where I'm going here, but We put a lot of money into this, making this space that was a bank and turned it into a restaurant, and so much infrastructure and helicoptering in, you know, the exhaust fans and you know, he got a good deal for the property, you know, and he's getting good terms for rent and everything. And so, but the economy took a dive. And at that time, you know, he just couldn't keep it going. And it's now it's a place called Misfit. And they basically took it over, you know, basically a dime on the dollar for what was invested into the whole thing. And now they're successful at the other guy's.
You know, and they have a remarkable space, I bet.
Exactly, right. So that's like, they tell the restaurateurs, find a good good location that was a restaurant.
Tell me your approach to designing the kitchen in a restaurant. And do you use any of the same principles that you would use in a residential?
You know, in a residential, we're actually doing a residential project up in Santa Rosa now, and it's so much different. It, you know, the expectations are a lot of different. The approach is still the same in terms of, you know, trying to find trying to create the sequence of events. You know, from you coming into the door to your next, you know, your path of travel and your experiential spatial relationships between each spaces. So, I mean, there's that similarity in between the two. But I think that in a restaurant, you know, you're thinking there's a lot more. You know, you have so many codes that you have to deal with that you know, residential you do too, but not as strict, and you're trying to, you know, get the maximum amount of seats because, you know, you need to get that.
So let me flip it on you.
Okay.
Do you use any of your industrial kitchen techniques in residential?
I do in a little bit. I mean, in my own home, like one of the principles that I learned in restaurants is, you know, you want the people that to be able to take the least amount of steps as possible. It's the triangle, you know. It's the, you know, you work here, you work there, you work there, and the vistas. You know, you want to have a hostess that has a good view of all the seats to see when something's starting to clear up, and so, you know, the views and the functionality that goes into a restaurant. You know, I applied them to my own home, and you know, I didn't want to be, because I like to cook, and I didn't want to be the guy stuck in the kitchen, and I wanted to see what was going on. So I applied a lot of those, you know, views and the triangle of workspaces to that, and you know, it's the same principles that I think, you know, just they work in both ways.
Going back to the shipping container,
uh-huh.
Is it LA County or LA City that just approved the granny flat?
Well, and the state just
is a state thing.
It's a state. Well, okay. A state thing. Well, each jurisdiction has its own, you know, ordinance of it. But the granny flats are definitely something that the state has been trying to encourage. Each, you know, in Santa Rosa, they're, you know, really trying to do that because they're trying to get more people to. You know, they're going to have a big housing problem over there. I was actually, one of my concepts was using shipping containers as temporary housing until they rebuild the homes after the fire, and then maybe incorporating the containers into the actual design so that either it becomes a granny flat that's detached from the house, or it's actually built into the design and you can move them like kit of parts.
Like you put a pivot on it and you just sort of swing it over, right?
Well, no, you just do it once.
Couple people lift it up, everyone grab a corner and we'll just move it on over here. No, I don't think so. But, you know, it's interesting too because you can sort of see the progression of things working,
uh-huh.
Right? You know, you've seen the tiny house movement.
Right.
And as an architect, does that make you cringe or does that make you excited?
You know, it makes me excited that people are thinking that way, you know, and, I think that if you look at residential homes, you know, seem to be getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And, you know, really what's necessary, you know, it's this, you know, do you really need to have, you know, more bedrooms and spaces that never get used? And so I think that, I mean, even Manhattan Beach, you know, the original houses were 800 to 1,000 square feet, and it seemed like everybody, you know, people could live in that fine. Of course,
they were second houses. They were beach cottages.
There was rich, and there were houses for the industries that, you know, in the areas.
Well, and it's interesting too, because at one time, the Manhattan Beach and adjacent real estate was the low end real estate,
right,
in LA County.
Right, right. Yeah, I had when I used to live on the Strand, and my landlord, who bought the whole block, he would tell me, he's like, well, you know, the only reason I bought this is because I wanted to buy Santa Monica, but I couldn't afford it, and this is the only place I could afford.
Isn't that amazing?
I know. I was like, damn, I wish I would have bought that time.
Yeah, but I know. What year was that?
1920.
You know, yeah. So that's the thing, too, is it's all relative.
Yeah.
You know, it's really interesting to me how your industry... Mm-hmm. And I guess a lot of people don't think about this because they think about when they're using an architect that everything has to be high end.
Right.
Right. But you think about it, your industry in this marketplace, mm-hmm, where the real estate prices are going through the roof,
right,
which begets a lot of development and redevelopment, which is good.
Right.
But at the same time, it's like it gets harder and harder for people to find a place.
Yeah.
So it'd be great to go back to the 20s and buy it on.
Exactly. Buy one of those. You got to find the next good place to be. I mean, when we bought our house in Manhattan Beach, and it was only because out of necessity, because we outgrew our place. We had a little kid, and, you know, there's no place for him to play. I mean, we had the big beach there, which was plenty fun. But then we traded a view for a yard and bought it in the tree section. But I think we got our house for like $414, you know, which, you know, is unheard of.
Isn't that crazy? And again, it's all relative too, because you look at $414 and you say, okay, let's look at Memphis or Nashville,
right,
which now it's getting harder in those markets,
right,
but, you know, certain areas in Texas or anywhere in the flyover states for the most part, right?
Yeah.
And it's just getting crazy.
Yeah, no, it is. And I think that, you know, you have to do what's right for you at the time, you know, and if you happen to be lucky, like I was with that purchase, I actually thought that house was going to be just a temporary place. And then, you know, then the economy kind of took a...
Made your choice for you.
Made my choice great. Made myself brilliant.
Exactly.
So, you know, I think that same as the restaurant in Santa Monica that was, you know, the timing of everything is really has a lot to do with the success of it. I mean, MB Post, you know, Manhattan Beach was just ready for something like that to be there, you know?
Yeah.
And so luck is a big part of it.
Luck is always a big part of it. Stephen, where can people find you?
Well, you can go to my website. It is sfjones.com. My office is in Marina Del Rey.
Everything's on the website.
Everything's on the website.
Yeah. Outstanding. This was great. Stephen, thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Convo by Design is proud to be working with Vendome Furniture. Design culture, it's the key to their success. It's what pushes them to consistently create new collections that give spaces a new dimension. They create dialogue between environment and form. Vendome pieces can transform the simplest space into one filled with glamour that is both unique and extraordinary. And isn't that what design is all about? Creating atmospheres where you can take hold of life and enjoy it to the fullest? Vendome products are simple and elegant, contemporary and exceptionally comfortable. Their crafted, modern, durable, molded resin, glass, and metal designs are unique and they beg to be enjoyed. They search the planet for the right designers that embody the Vendome spirit and work together to create remarkable pieces into an exclusively Vendome mode of expression. And if you haven't seen Von Dahn before, you can check them out in some of the Convo by Design videos you'll find on our YouTube channel. But you can find them in their showrooms at the D&D Building in New York, Wynwood in Miami, and the Pacific Design Center here in LA, or online at vondahn.com.